The Real Housewives of Fighting in the War Room. In honor of Annabelle the Creation, what's your favorite piece of spinoff culture?
I'm Katie Rich, and I'm going with a show that I have actually watched, which is called First Chester Hotel, which is a spinoff of Sesame Street, and it is like Fawlty Towers with Muppets, and Elmo and Cookie Monster are on it. It's very enjoyable.
I was about to say, is that an actual spinoff? I've never heard you describe it as a spinoff. I've heard you talk about it a lot, but never
a spinoff. I don't remember if I've talked about it on the show, but
you have a little.
Everyone should watch it.
I am Matt Batches, and I think I'm going to go with The Simpsons, which is a spinoff of The Tracey Ullman Show. And if that doesn't really count, my backup is Freakazoid, a spinoff of Animaniacs.
Oh, that's why you were humming the Freakazoid theme. I get it now. Hey, it's me, Dave.
Freakazoid. Sorry, interrupting Freakazoid. Go.
It's me, David the Seven, and I'm going to say kablam with an exclamation point. It's a Nickelodeon stop-motion show that was spun off of All That. Back in this time called the 90s.
And I'm David Ehrlich, and I think this counts. I'm going to go with Space Ghost Coast to Coast, which I suppose could be argued is spun off from the Space Ghost animated series from way back when.
I think you'd have to argue that in order to give it as your answer for this question.
In this context, I'm legally bound to argue that. And Space Ghost Coast to Coast still... the densest, most hilarious thing I've ever seen on television or any other screen. The Tom York episode, which feels truly like it was made just for me, knifing around. I can quote the whole thing from start to finish. It's brilliant.
Was the Brack Show a spinoff of Space Ghost Coast to Coast?
A spinoff of a spinoff.
Now that is a show that was a spinoff called The Brack Show.
Brack Show.
It's the Brack Show. It's the Brack Show, starring me and Brack.
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Fine, I can hear you now, Dimitri. Clear and plain and coming through fine. I'm coming through fine too, eh? Good, then. Well, then, as you say, we're both coming through fine. Good. Well, it's good that you're fine and I'm fine. I agree with you. It's great to be fine.
It's a podcast. Hello and welcome to Fighting in the War Room. It's episode 177, and it's Tuesday, August 8th. And on this day in 1974, President Richard Nixon announced he would resign at 12 p.m. the next day. It's a lot for us to hope that history could repeat itself.
I put that down just to see if you would make that comment.
I mean, yeah. I was on vacation for a week. I don't know what's happened in the last week. It doesn't seem like anything's going to change in the White House, but I live in hope.
Donald Trump's going to go on laughing.
Yeah,
Donald Trump has fled the White House for at least 17 days.
Probably on a more relaxing vacation than I was.
I was about to say, I'm jealous.
Today it rained, and so he couldn't play golf, and so he sat in his office somewhere in Long Island or wherever, New Jersey, wherever the fuck he is, and went fucking Jersey. Ape shit on Twitter. So
it's called a spinoff of the White House. It's Trump in Jersey.
You could tell he was just pouting because his tea time was canceled.
August movies are bad, and he's sad about it.
I didn't go on Twitter at all on my vacation, so mine was better. So take that, Donald Trump. Anyway, we are all back, and apparently we still have some reviews to go through.
We do. We do indeed.
We're about to get 18 negative ones, but what are the ones we have before that?
Why? Just for teeing off against Donald Trump's tea time? Oh, I think we've already weeded out most of the fascists out there. Anyway.
Okay.
great film. Well, let's see. Maybe this first review references what we're talking about. Kyle Hello says, great film podcast until ... and gives us a truly pathetic 4 stars.
Mm.
This podcast is one of my favorite discussions of film. I follow all each members individually and appropriate the various perspectives. What I don't get is undeserved love of Chris Nolan. Can you objectively review his films when you sing his praises prior to seeing the film? I will agree that the large format is great and would have been better used by a director who would use interesting angles, move the camera, thought of editing as a tool to his benefit. What I don't get is why they do not analyze each film when each member has poignant and witty observations about most films.
I mean, that's definitely referencing when we talked about Dunkirk, and David, only you had seen it, so we talked about large format.
Right.
But then the next week, we talked about Dunkirk, all four of us.
Yeah,
so.
And this the first time in ages that we all four of us had seen the movie. So
that was wonderful.
We'll try to do more of that.
I have to say, it just sounds like a review of someone who is not a particularly big fan of Christopher Nolan and is frustrated with us for enjoying some of his films.
I've never heard of anyone on the internet being passionate about Christopher Nolan one way or another, so I'm surprised by this.
Yes. You know what? I'm going to go ahead and say that this review was helpful because it reminded us that there are people on the internet. And now we have John Paul Ruby, who says, 5 stars, very good pod. All podcasts should be filled with good people. And this one is. Was this review helpful? I think to us.
Certainly.
Yes. It reminded us of our inherent goodness. And also to the people who were reading our reviews and considering whether or not to listen to a podcast. I think it's helpful to know that it's a podcast made of good people. So I will say yes. And finally, Bailey Tuttle says, 5 stars. Has there been updates? Please update. Please. No blame.
Now that's a Christopher Nolan tweet. I want to go deeper.
Thank you, Christopher Nolan, for listening to our podcast. we are updating at this very moment, just for your pleasure. No blame given, no blame received. Was this review helpful? I'm tempted to report a concern. I'm not sure what that concern would be, but its review is a little distressing in its own right. Be that as it may, I'm going to say this review was quite helpful.
It was tapped out by a telegraph sent from far away.
Sent from a black hole.
Yeah.
We appreciate all of your reviews. We will find most of them helpful, so please keep leaving them. And also, we still have a quarter call coming up as a reminder. So that is a great time to tell people to start listening because those are especially good episodes. And we want your contributions to it, Patches. What do we want from people?
Yeah, so for this upcoming Quarter Quell, if you follow us on Facebook or Twitter, you've seen us kind of beaming this message out. But our plan is to talk about old conversations, go back to topics that we've dug into before, reapproach them years probably later because we have put out the old Opkino archives for people to dig through if they choose, find our weird conversations and opinions from back in the day or earlier episodes.
It was really well hidden at fightinginthewarroom.com/Opkino_classic.
Well, classic is not an easy thing to suss out. You know.
Sounds like suspiciously like a reboot episode. We are dredging up old episodes. And
it's more of a clip show.
New takes on them, I suppose. I don't know. I feel like Fighting in the War Room is the latest victim of reboot culture.
Yeah,
maybe
we got to go back to the beginning. It's going to be quite gritty, from my understanding. It's a whole new.
It's gritty.
Yeah, but we might get the Zack Snyder version of Fighting in the War Room when we go back to the beginning. We'll see what happens. You can tell us what you want us to talk about. Or we're going to figure out what we're going to talk about ourselves by going back into the archives if we dare to listen to our younger voices. But if you have ideas, leave them at Facebook or Twitter. It's the dream.
Patches, you subjected yourself to the Dark Tower movie single film adaptation this week.
Yeah, many people did, apparently, according to the box office. I think it made like less than $20 million it didn't cost a lot of money. They started this franchise
pretty low. $19 million, which I'm told by people who know how to read is somehow significant to the Dark Knight mythology. The Dark Knight, what the fuck are we talking about? The Dark Tower.
That's true. 19 is an important number throughout the saga and through Stephen King's book. So I guess this is a win for the Dark Tower.
Good job staying in canon.
Yeah,
18% on Rotten Tomatoes, so couldn't quite seal the deal there.
Woof. And yeah, apparently it was $60 million budget, according to Box Office Mojo. So 19's not great in terms of that, but Dave, why didn't you see it? I thought you were a huge Dark Tower fan.
I am, and I think that's why I didn't see it, is there was a lot of press that I think was, well, it starts any time that a movie is held back from any sort of screening for as long as Dark Tower was. And then there was, I believe, a Variety or Hollywood Reporter story about how maybe the movie had been sort of messed with by the studio because a lot of the screenings hadn't gone well. And then finally, once the review embargo went up, hearing the plot of the movie described, I lost interest in trekking to the theater to see whatever Sony thinks the Dark Tower should be when I, you know, experienced. It was basically my, like, Harry Potter come down. Like, I did all the Harry Potter books, and then the last one came out, and I'm like, well, that's done. And someone was like, hey, this Dark Tower thing's just wrapping up. It turns out the entire thing was worth it, so I jumped back and Dark Towered it.
The book series is finished?
Yes.
Although it could pop up again. Who knows? I'm sorry?
The book series is really great. So I am not a huge Stephen King fan, yeah, but I've read enough because both my brother and my mother are huge Stephen King fans. So they've, you know, my brother was like reading it in middle school and was like that sort of weird kid. So
reading the book It.
Yes.
Okay. Not yeah. The dark. Yeah.
You got to put a lot of emphasis on It.
Oh, yeah. Sorry.
He's reading and so, It.
Yeah, and then The Dark Tower is this arch narrative that connects to Stephen King's other narrative books. He's paused for a while after the fourth book in what was planned to be a seventh book series, and it didn't look like he was going to finish it. Then he went through the personal tragedy where he got hit by a van, and that sort of like remotivated him to finish the series so that the final book of the seventh book cycle, The Dark Tower, came out in 2004, and I joined it soon after. Anyway, but the book's really rewarding because it's allowed to be that dense, and it's allowed to be a mix of a whole bunch of different genres from both like the Western, which is seems very obvious with like the gunslinger sort of imagery, to like there's one part in the books where they fight robots with lightsabers that are dressed like Dr. Doom from the Fantastic Four that are like riding on horses. It spans a whole bunch of different fictional genres. It talks about fiction of a whole. It talks about creation. And what it sounds like is the movie we got was, I don't know, a blended version of the characters and settings, but with none of that like greater thematic text that made The Dark Tower worthwhile the first time around.
Will it blend? The will question of the internet.
Thrilling.
So why hire Matthew McConaughey and Idris Elba and presumably pay them a lot of money and kind of thin out your entire, you know, universe that you're trying to create? Like, why make it this way?
I think there's an obvious answer to that, and because you need to make a big movie that can play to everyone and take the mythology and draw out its blockbustery elements. But still on a budget. Like, this movie is a miscalculation from the very beginning because it wants to service fans and service, you know, the Chinese box office or something. You know, that's our default for like the Fast and the Furious, big, loud, you know, cacophony, blockbusterness. But I think it's trying to do both of those things at once and fails at both, mostly because the Dark Tower books were never like that. It could never get that big. You have Idris Elba playing the gunslinger, Roland, and, you know, his conflict is never going to be that big. He's going to have one-on-one or like groups of people, big shootouts and that sort of thing. But this movie doesn't have the budget to actually have big set pieces or be Lord of the Rings like the mythology intends it to be. I mean, the books are really the Fellowship of the Ring spread over five or six volumes with like, you know, Magnificent Seven interludes and other adventures, side quests. And it's really just hanging out with great characters.
So you're telling me that a 95-minute film was not the ideal way of approaching this?
So what's interesting about this is that J.J. Abrams wanted to make this for a long time. He and Damon Lindelof were the first people to get their hands on this and really declare we're going to make The Dark Tower, which based on Dave's description of the books, you can understand. There's this like pop culture element. You know, you have Stephen King high on cocaine writing his dream fantasy, all pop culture that's just wrapped into one giant crazy-ass story. And it's a huge puzzle box because as the gunslinger and his comrades Jake and Eddie and Susanna, as they're traversing this mid-world parallel universe, they're encountering, you know, like Dave said, they're seeing imagery that reminds us of our world, but they're also encountering like roller coasters and amusement parks and like Exxon Mobil stations. And it's all so trippy and weird, and it runs parallel. And, you know, they're chasing the Dark Tower. It's the center of the universe. And you can go to all pockets of the universe from this one place. And it's crazy. It's just a crazy story, but it starts with The Gunslinger, the first book that is very small. And it's just about the gunslinger, which this would have been Idris Elba, chasing Walter, the man in black, Matthew McConaughey. So these things make it into the final movie. But it's just a really small little adventure, a pulp novel. And you get none of that here. You get all seven books slammed into one crazy-ass, exposition-free, you know, adventure, an underworld movie, essentially. Of it's actually more like Last Action Hero. So this kid, Jake, is really the star. It's kind of a YA setup. He's living in New York. He's going crazy. He's having visions. Frankly, you know, we had so much conversation, or we personally didn't, but the internet did, about how Rey was a Mary Sue for J.J. Abrams and like all of fandom to inject themselves into Star Wars. I don't really buy that. That's kind of nonsense. But I'll tell you what, Jake in the Dark Tower is a Mary Sue. He's drawing pictures of Roland. He's obsessed with the Dark Tower and the Gunslinger, and he gets to finally meet him. It's just like Last Action Hero, because eventually he crosses into Midworld, meets the Gunslinger, and they all come back and they fight Walter. There's no exposition. All this mythology we've been going on and on about isn't in the movie at all. You get a little trace of it, but it's just madness.
Wait, is that character in the book?
Jake, the kid?
Yeah.
Yes. But so in this first book, he crosses over into Midworld, into the Gunslinger's world. And it's actually really emotional, because he's the Gunslinger is trying to protect him throughout this, and has to. I'm going to spoil it like a 35, 40 year old book right now. Jake dies in the book, and it kind of like weighs on the Gunslinger quite a bit. And it's a very emotional. I also read these books, if that's not clear. I was very moved by it. I was really into the characters. So Dave and I have that alike. We made it to the end of The Dark Tower.
Yeah.
And, well, there's cared rumors about that this they adaptation. Shot
that ending, and that was what made the test screenings really? Last year go so poorly.
Well, the end of this movie is definitely reshot on a different day in an LA studio, and it's complete garbage. It's hilarious. But
well, this just sounds like a great idea from start to finish.
But let me say this. As a Dark Tower fan, I still kind of enjoy is hard, but like it's so exposition-free. It's 90 minutes, a breezy 90 minutes. It's just Idris Elba's charisma and Matthew McConaughey hamming it up like there's no tomorrow. It's like insane. This is the Akiva Goldsman aspect. So he had a hand in writing this script. And the thing Akiva Goldsman does
is
Batman and Robin. You know, Batman and Robin is not a quits hit. Batman and Robin is pure Akiva Goldsman, and he's been doing Batman and Robin ever since, hamming it up, giving actors lines, like crazy lines. Winter's Tale is like this too. Give him the juice, you know. Behind closed doors, I've heard people talk about how Akiva Goldsman and his cabal of writers, like Jeff Pinker, who worked on Amazing Spider-Man 2 and Fringe and all these guys, they just know how to get a room, they know how to pitch, and they know how to give actors juicy lines, crazy lines. And Matthew McConaughey is just full of it here. He's like, have a great apocalypse, as he's frying chicken in someone's apartment. It just like, it's complete nonsense. The movie is insane. But on some level, it's kind of fun because there's no exposition. It's just crazy stuff happening from beginning to end.
Could that save it? Like, even if, could our second step into the Dark Tower repivot and not lose anything essential from this misfire?
No, because nothing happens in this movie. It's a complete beginning to end. I mean, I'm going to go into spoiler territory now because I don't think anyone here cares. And if you're listening and you still intend to see this movie, and spoiler free, maybe jump ahead like 2 minutes. So Matthew McConaughey dies at the end of this movie. He gets shot in the head. It's over. The whole movie, seven books worth of material, starts and finishes in this movie. Now, of course, as has been written about in, you know, countless times in the production of this movie, it's kind of a sequel to the books because it's remixing all the aspects, and it's technically, if you know the end of the books, you find out that Roland the Gunslinger has been going, he's been living in a loop. He follows the path to the Dark Tower. He wants to find the Dark Tower to have understanding of life, and when he gets there, he goes back in time and restarts his path. It's like he is keeping the universe intact by chasing the Dark Tower. This movie supposes that he could break free and maybe end his monotonous life. But then it's all over at the end. So yes, Dave, in fact, you could have sequels of Jake and the Gunslinger just doing whatever, or they still are talking about making a TV series, something Ron Howard wanted to do when he took over this movie years ago, doing Wizard and Glass, the fourth book, which is a prequel, young Gunslinger stuff. You could rewrite this whole, you could write this movie out of the canon and yet still keep what they set up in this movie. That's how crazy it is. You could have Game of Thrones set in the old West. You could have Westworld meets Game of Thrones, do it as the Dark Tower TV series, and then reboot the property with somehow using the same. I mean, there's no point in keeping anything from this movie. It's a whiff, but you don't have to necessarily abandon the Dark Tower as a viable property in the future.
Yeah, I feel like that would be the positive side to at least keeping to trying to attempt this narrative. Because I kind of feel like the Dark Tower as a film franchise just like started gaining enough momentum that by the time they realized it was unsavable, they had signed on all these stars and had multiple versions of the script, and like, we're definitely going to make a Dark Tower movie. So I'm hoping something could be salvaged from the wreck. Who knows?
The worst part about this movie is that Katie doesn't live in New York anymore, and I couldn't sit next to her watching this movie as, like, Idris Elba runs around in a duster killing rat people and robots and vampires, and there's a house demon that tries to eat the boy. It's actually a house. It's just, and Matthew McConaughey uses, like, orbs to look into the future and then look into other worlds. It's such crazy, and all of it has roots in the books. Like, it's all drawing from the mythology and the iconography of the Dark Tower books, but none of it is explained, and none of it matters. None of it has weight. It's crazy.
Does Matthew McConaughey, given that he is essentially playing the devil, ever get to transform into an insidious other form?
No, he doesn't have a Winter's... now I'm forgetting the name of the movie. The Cuba Goldsman. Winter's Tale, where Will Smith... his giant devil jaws open up. Nothing that crazy. He only gets a like psychically throw around glass. It's not too exciting, unfortunately.
Fucking hiding that. Lame.
Yeah, he just does stuff you do in your New York apartment. In a New York apartment, too. That's the best part of this movie is that it was shot on the streets of New York. And you can just imagine people like gawking at Matthew McConaughey as he walked, like strutting down the street in all black, crazy, bad wig or hair dye job. And it's just like, everything is so embarrassing about this movie. Total miscalculation.
Man, McConaissance was good while it lasted.
I think it can move past this. No one will remember this happened. No one saw it.
The same character in The Stand. Just get The Stand going again.
There you go. So The Dark Tower, I've convinced you all to see it, right?
Oh, yeah.
No.
This movie premiered at the Museum of Modern Art, apparently.
That's good.
I'm good.
Yeah, you should read the books.
Fair enough.
Read the books, Katie, because Stephen King
fans... Listen, I've read The Stand. I'm familiar with The Man in Black. I probably should have read it by now.
Yeah, I don't know why, but Stephen King fans... Well, Dave, you end this segment because you said your brother and your mom love Stephen King, but did they read these books?
They did. Oh. They're just not way into it I was. There's something about what they enjoy in a good Stephen King novel is, like, you know, little characters and maybe moments of tension. I think by the time Stephen King himself shows up in the Dark Tower books, they were like, okay, lesser work. We understand this is where he has fun, but I don't think they're like it's in high esteem, whereas they're my favorite Stephen King books.
That'll be the greatest missed opportunity, not getting to the Dark Tower like 3 or 4 and having Stephen King enter the narrative like he does in the books. And just him and Idris Elba hanging out.
Gallingly obvious that the right play here was to do, I think, what they were planning to do originally, which is like a Game of Thrones like prestige TV series,
right?
And now
they wanted it all. They wanted to do huge $100 million blockbusters and a Game of Thrones series. What's weird is in like the course correction or the publicity play before this movie came out, Tom Rothman, former president of Fox, and now he's at Sony doing these movies, he was comparing this to Game of Thrones. Like, Game of Thrones is the real competition now. I find that particularly fascinating because, Katie, you were saying, why did this movie have to take this route? What was it trying to do? Well, it's trying to have all this mythology so that, you know, people who obsess over Game of Thrones and theories and the world and, like, what does this mean? What does this mean? What does this mean? Those people have tons of catnip in this movie. But then people who don't want to understand anything, they try to make a movie for them too. So you get both worlds, parallel universes, the Dark Tower.
Yeah, after Westworld managed to become a prestige series, I really feel like everyone should know Anything Is Possible.
In the Dark Tower.
Yo, who that boy? Who him is? Him that nigga, I swear. Stand out guy, him don't need no chair. Well, where the fuck him at? Cause nigga, I'm right here. I don't shop at the mall, all y'all just dumb motherfucker. I'm a goddamn artist. You can give me some markers and I draw you a clock.
Alright, so for our mini segment today, we were talking about a movie that I am very, very pleased to see is not only now out and playing in theaters, where a movie like this is no longer guaranteed to open at all, but is doing really well, and it's getting a lot of rave reviews from highfalutin places. An editor's pick in the New York Times. That's exciting. Anyway, I'm talking about Columbus, which is a film that premiered at Sundance. And what's interesting about Columbus
is it's not in Ohio.
It's
true. It's not Columbus, Ohio. It's Columbus, Indiana.
No, it's Columbus. Yeah, of course. No, it's not the city. It's Columbus in the film may technically be a city, but it's not the Columbus you're thinking of. It is Columbus, Indiana, I want to say, right?
Yes.
Columbus, Indiana, the modernist, the capital of modernist architecture, the unassuming capital of modernist architecture in the United States.
I was not aware of that.
No, I don't think that many people were.
But now I want to move there.
People live in Columbus who may not know this, but... Columbus is a movie that I have described not because it's accurate, because it's accurate enough and succinct, as sort of Garden State as directed by Ozu.
It's just not fair.
Ozu is certainly a very explicit influence on this film because its maker is a guy who it goes by the name of Koganada. Now, if you are familiar with that name, it's probably because Koganada has... really become one of the most accomplished and impressive video essayists in this sort of burgeoning new form that we have. His supercuts, so to speak, although I think that term tends to demean them, about modernity in Ozu and about single perspective shots in Kubrick. And I mean, there are a number of them. They're all on Vimeo. Not all of them are on Vimeo. The ones he made for himself or on Vimeo, a number of them were commissioned by the BFI or the Criterion Collection and so on and are available in other places. But they're really, really elegant, beautiful works of art unto themselves. And he, to the best of my knowledge, has become the first of these video essayists to make the transition from Supercuts to Sundance, and that's where this movie premiered. That really could have gone either way, I think, as a longtime fan of his. And you know, I know the guy and I like him as a person, and I'm like, I was rooting for him, but a bit skeptical as to how this would pay off, and was relieved at first and then much more profoundly sort of enchanted and beguiled by what he's made with this movie, which really does a beautiful job of porting over and suffusing his influences and the things that he has studied and woven into his work and sort of made new work from before in the past into something beautiful and uniquely expressive and new. I'll hand it off in just a sec, but the basics, it's a story starring Haley Lou Richardson, who you may know from the masterpiece we call The Edge of 17, played Haley Steinfeld's friend. She's a girl, college-age girl, who is still living at home with her addict mother. The mother is sort of a peripheral character. She's very smart. She's very into architecture and the modernist architecture in this town, which was built at a time of hope and is now sort of decaying and unused and unlooked upon. And she meets a guy played by John Cho, whose father is a very, very famous architect who is in a coma in the hospital. So he, who gives no fucks about architecture whatsoever, comes home and their paths cross.
Yeah, and then so... basically, this girl is stuck in Columbus, Indiana, by her own choice. I mean, she's very aware that she has never left home. She could go to college. You know, she kind of forms this relationship with John Cho's character because they bump into each other walking around town and admiring the buildings or trying to find something to do. She sees beauty there and he sees frustration and an end to life, literally, his father's dying. And she sees the only place that she can ever go. And they form this friendship around the beauty. You know, she can take him everywhere and show him this place that's so much more than he can realize. And what he can do for her is open her mind to the possibilities of a world beyond Columbus, Indiana. And
can you give me a specific example of that? Because it could be like, you know, what does a peach taste like to you? Or it could be really heartwarming.
Wait, what? Oh, I'm sorry. What? Now I want that.
You're like, she could open his eyes to the like the mundane things around him. Like, do they go to an amusement park?
Right.
Or
we're talking about Koganada being an expert at, you know, supercuts and taking footage and finding beauty and in juxtaposition or repurposing the footage to reframe it in a new context. That's what he's essentially doing to the architecture, the modernist architecture in Columbus, Indiana. For bits of this movie, it's really this kind of like blissful floating through nature and constructed man-made objects and like admiring them from afar and framing things in just the perfect way so that these two people looking at buildings and places around town is just as thrilling to you as the viewer. Like, you can get lost in it. It's a very empathetic experience of her being transfixed by these buildings, and the filmmaking complements that. And so she is going around town showing him what he could never see because he's caught up in day to day. He's caught up in life, and she can kind of stand back from it and really admire beauty. And this movie just takes this, again, this blissful kind of like Zen tone to the middle of nowhere, essentially. But it's becomes a tragic story for her. It's so comforting to be here, and it's so beautiful that she never really decided to get on with her life. As we mentioned, her mother is a recovering addict, and she's struggling to keep a job and maintain a life. But this young college-age girl feels like she needs to take responsibility for her mother and needs to make a life here, because if she left, who knows what could happen? The whole place, the whole building could fall apart if she left. She's the foundation. So you just have this really beautiful dynamic between these two people. I haven't seen such a naturalistic movie since maybe like Before Midnight, where you just feel like two people are really talking and really expressing themselves and having frank conversations about how they're feeling on the inside. And I think Koganada, through composing, you know, landscape, really ends up capturing beautiful portraits of this movie. And that's kind of the whole thing.
Is it not Garden State? Is that it feels...
That's why, yeah.
The way that Garden State feels very manufactured.
Yeah, I gnash my teeth when David says that. I mean, it's a good tweet. I'll give him that. The Ozu is more...
When you describe it, it's like a guy comes to town and a girl teaches him to see things. Like, I think of Garden State, and I think
sure,
a lot of people would.
But it's not that twee. You know what I mean? Like, this could be two people who really need to find themselves and like see the world and find beauty and, you know, be the ideal of the dude in your MFA, to use that Twitter account joke. You know, it's like this pedantic, narcissistic way of looking at beauty, and as if the world exists for you to see it the right way and for you to have a transcendent experience. It's much more organic than that. This is really two people colliding under circumstances, because of where they are in life, it just seems to twist and turn in tandem for a moment, and they become deeply entrenched in each other's lives. They just find a pace to this that doesn't force a single movement in the plot. And I think that's the real beauty of it. But yeah, it's, I haven't watched Garden State in a very long time, but there's certainly no like Zach Braff stands in front of the wallpaper that his shirt is also the same pattern nonsense.
Oh, but that,
you know,
that,
I mean,
shot gets so much information about his character across.
But I mean, that's not a real person.
I'm joking.
Right? That's
okay.
Okay. My heart sank a little, wouldn't you?
So Columbus is now in theaters and not on VOD?
I think it's actually expanding, isn't it?
It's very possible. I don't think it's on VOD. It's just going to float through. It's a small distributor, but it's scattered around the country. It'll definitely be streaming soon, but I would recommend seeing. I saw this again at Sundance on a big screen, and I was totally blissed out. I felt like I went to the spa. I wanted to move immediately to Columbus, Indiana, and stare at buildings just like Haley Lou Richardson, who I really think is one of the most fantastic actresses working right now. She's young and has a whole career ahead of her, and I'm so excited to see what she does, because I'm really like It was such a great performance. And so same with John Cho, like all the, you know, cries to get this man leading man work. And what a great actor. What a like compassionate, observant human force to be in movies, who's funny and dramatic. And I know he's awesome. So both of these people are in the same movie. See it, Columbus.
Is this the right time to remind everyone that John Cho is 45 years old?
Whoa. I mean, yeah. I don't know. I'm not judging that.
I'm not either. He looks incredible.
He's worldly.
He should continue to do whatever he's doing.
Eat White Castle burgers.
Someday he'll outlive that movie.
No.
Maybe not. No.
Why is it so hard to accept the party is over? You came with your new friends and her mom jeans and her new Vans, and she's perfect and I hate it. Oh, so glad you made it. I'm so glad you could come back. Somebody get the tacos. Somebody spark the blood.
So before we move on to our final segment, we should note that we have lost David due to technical difficulties and or the fact that he and John Cho have run away together.
To admire buildings in Columbus, Indiana.
Yeah,
just
it
staring.
Sounds amazing.
Oh, it's just so beautiful. I can't express it enough.
This segment isn't about Columbus.
I'm in love.
But actually, Columbus is an interesting transition into what we want to talk about, which is just kind of a general look at summer box office, because Columbus is a theatrical-only release. It's going to be an interesting route for it to take through summer box office, which is kind of notoriously difficult. But the thing that I kind of wanted to start talking about as we got into looking at how the summer has been as a whole is what has happened with The Big Sick, which came out at the end of June. It hasn't even been out for a month and a half. It's already grossed $33 million, which is really a lot for a theatrical gross for a movie like this that, you know, with two more different decisions that it totally could have gotten to VOD. And in my travel, when I drove from North Carolina to Michigan and back, I noticed it was playing at the number of like fairly rural multiplexes. It has a much wider release than I think most people living in the city would expect. It's been in over 2,500 theaters. So I was kind of excited to see that success story. And maybe to start things off, what other success stories from this summer are giving you guys hope?
The Book of Henry, no. David, what's giving...
That
or
happened
Dave,
this summer, huh?
I'm looking at an article. So David wrote an article. I think this is why he wanted to talk about this. So I'm sad he's not here. But he wrote an article on IndieWire called The 10 Reasons Why 2017 Has Been the Best Summer Movie Season Ever. And one of his points, and I think it's important to talk about this too, like obviously there were successes. You know, you saw Baby Driver, which even if I didn't care for it, at least that's an original movie with a vision. And that's definitely the movie Edgar Wright wanted to make. It's great to see that that movie does really well. And it's great to see that Dunkirk does really well. You know, a name like Christopher Nolan, a director can sell a movie, essentially. Dunkirk is not a summer movie by any means, other than like the IMAX spectacle. And that's how they sold it. And it's been paying off big time for them. But I think the key thing that David mentions here is that like bad movies are failing at the box office. The Emoji Movie is limping to the finish line here. And you see, I mean, The Dark Tower, it's a mess. It's business first movie making, trying to hit all quadrants, and that's flopping. And you have a movie like Transformers, The Last Knight. This should be a guarantee. This is like a $400 million grosser right here. And it's like, no, $130 million. It's the number 17 movie of the year. It's made less than Dunkirk. It's made less than Planet of the Apes. It's made less than Get Out, right? These movies are failing. And I guess on some level, it's schadenfreude for us, people who really want great movies to be plastered on the walls of our movie theaters every summer. This is a win, right?
It signals a shift, at least, because as long as we've been doing this show, the prevailing like sort of, I don't know, tribalist sassy attitude that we have is that occasionally the masses accept a piece of crap and we have to like deal with it. This year, I'm not sure outside, definitely not this summer, I haven't seen an example of it, but like this year outside of something like Beauty and the Beast, which, you know, you can have your own personal feelings about whether or not you like it, the rate of how much I agree with things succeeding is what I agree most with that point from David.
I feel like we have fewer horrible movies that make tons of money and more like anonymous movies.
Right.
And I don't know how we feel about Despicable Me making, you know, $240 million.
I feel like animated movies are almost a separate category. Like, those will make money at a rate that is so out of proportion to whether or not they're good or bad.
Right.
But the fact Logan has made almost as much as Despicable Me 3, that's kind of crazy.
Right. Small movie, R-rated.
Yeah.
But these aren't, we're not even talking about the summer when we talk about Logan.
Well, I mean, if we are talking about summer-wise, we went through the summer with basically no bomb superhero property, and they're all sequels. So that's at least counterproductive to what we thought would happen at this point down the line with these like huge franchises and studios trying to jockey things closer to or away from like Spider-Man Homecoming and Wonder Woman. Is it going to ruin female superhero movies forever? But no, we've been blessed with very watchable blockbusters from our, I don't know, our content mills, if you will.
I mean, there was Resident Evil, the final chapter, but I guess that's a video game.
Also, I think that did well enough for Resident Evil, the final chapter, that they will forever look at the Resident Evil series as a gross win for.
Well, the thing that we're not talking about is international grosses. I mean, Resident Evil, the final chapter, made $285 worldwide. Transformers: The Last Night, even though like it didn't seem like anyone in the United States cared about it, it made $454 million worldwide. So it, like, these franchises are all doing fine. And what I think is really interesting about things like The Big Sick and Baby Driver is like maybe like the domestic box office is less and less important for studios. But what people are realizing is that the thing that people will actually go out to see for American audiences are unique and different and something that's actually motivating. Like, my parents went to see Baby Driver, which I never would have expected, and really liked it because it was something different. And that's an interesting trend that I hope.
Why did they go see Baby Driver?
My dad wanted to go see a movie, and I asked him if he liked car chase movies like Bullet, and he said he did, and so he convinced my mom to go see it, and they both loved it.
So the key is to listen to a podcast like this to get recommendations for the movies.
Yeah, or if you are the parent of a person, right, the host of this podcast, just ask.
Help her. Your parents. You failed them on the election, but this time you can get them on the movies. No, it's being mean.
But like, I guess my parents never would have gone to see Pirates of the Caribbean or Transformers or like Batman, but that was something with like actual human beings in it that they really liked.
Although
I'm
still
interested to see how this. Go ahead, Patches.
No, I was just going to say that I feel like there's more evangelizing to be done, that we get stuck in seeing the same old movies. Well, I don't know. I'm thinking about Girls Trip right now, and I want everyone to see Girls Trip.
I was wondering when you were
going to
bring up Girls Trip.
But even, I mean, how do you get people to see comedies in theaters? How do you get people to see little movies in theaters? I guess they do.
Girls Trip's doing fine.
Girls Trip's making a lot of money. I mean,
it's making enough money for what it is. Not only that, but it's holding pretty well, which I guess is.
I mean, enough money for it's made more than The Mummy and Alien Covenant. Like, it's doing great.
But do you see these numbers? If this is a numbers game, I guess Hollywood is the business and it's always going to be a numbers game. Are these numbers competing with, we don't have real data, or I don't even know how you compare these metrics, but like in the age of Netflix, in the age of Game of Thrones, which is clearly, as we were talking about in the Dark Knight the Dark Tower segment, that is a threat to these movies. People would rather invest deeply in an episodic experience and have long standing mythology, and that's riding a wave into season 7 of Game of Thrones, crazy action. You can get it all from this, you know, from your home. Are these movies, are these success stories actually success stories, or are there a few minor hits? Are people going back to the movies, or is this like slowly being chipped away? Are these totals actually kind of disappointing?
It's all anecdotal evidence,
sure.
But basically from my personal experiences this summer, Game of Thrones is like the focal point that you could kind of assume to water cooler about. But that being said, stuff like Get Out still comes up, where somebody finally gets around to seeing Get Out and brings it up, and everybody's like, oh yeah, I also saw Get Out. But like, there's been these things have had more legs, I think, in terms of their cachet of how much we talk about them than previous years, where it sort of feels like we'll get like, you know, a few weeks talking about the new flash in the pan thing in the weekend, and then we have to move on for like the next Thor movie. I feel like everybody, like, I had time to talk about War for the Planet of the Apes with people, and I don't think I saw that the first week it was out, but just because people eventually got around to it and it managed to keep it in the zeitgeist. But I don't know if it's like everybody's focused on it at the same time, a la Game of Thrones anymore. Like, we haven't had any of those.
But I think, I think the fact that we are having blockbusters with longevity, it's been a while since, I think Star Wars maybe is the best recent example, but Wonder Woman, that came out and people talked about it for weeks. I mean, Bill and Hillary Clinton just went to see it at the Alamo Drafthouse in Brooklyn. Like, that was part of the cultural conversation, this really new way, or not new, but kind of different from the last couple of summers. I can't say the same for Guardians of the Galaxy. Like, anecdotally, again, it doesn't feel to me like that, which was a really huge hit as well, stuck around in the same way. But to have one movie do it alone is an accomplishment.
Well, everyone was talking, Katie, about will Wonder Woman get nominated for an Oscar because it's been such a hit.
Will it? I heard about that.
Thoughts?
Oh, is that what we're asking?
I'm asking you. Oscar guru.
Am I just giving an up down? And
sure.
I would say no. I would say no, but many things are possible.
That is not an answer.
It's dumb to rule out anything at this point. If you wanted me to predict right now, I would say no.
Yeah, predict right now. No.
Okay, great. No.
I mean, there's just no way, right? It's just not a good enough movie. I don't want to be. I know it's an important win,
I'm just going to go look through like the most recent like Oscar nominees to discuss what's a good enough movie to get Oscar nominated, but you don't need me to do that.
Yeah, you could do like a sound effects editing Wonder Woman.
Oscar nominee, Hacksaw Ridge.
Yeah, okay. That is tough. But that has, well, I guess everyone, the conversation about this year's Oscars is that there's tons and tons of new people, mostly young, much more diverse than in the past. Anything's possible. If Wonder Woman is the social media winner of 2017, that could easily be the new standard for the Oscars. Then the reason Hacksaw Ridge gets in, because, you know, the old timers love Mel Gibson and love old fashioned movies, and what a piece of garbage. But like, you can understand.
I mean, my logic would be that there's probably room for one blockbuster from the summer, and it would be Dunkirk. But again, like you said, the Academy is changing a lot. So
yeah, Dunkirk seems like a shoe-in. But maybe,
again,
yeah, everything's changed. Yeah, you're right. You're right.
How did we wind up talking about the Oscars?
Well, because it's all connected. I mean, we're talking about the success stories of the summer here, and I feel like what's going to actually last through the summer. That's the most disappointing thing about the summer. David, in his IndieWire article, argues that, like, the blockbusters are good again. But, like, I don't feel like we're all talking about them. That's what's not fun. Dunkirk felt that way. Maybe it's just because on this podcast, we all saw Dunkirk and we got to have a great time.
As in the people on this schedule.
Yeah. I mean, we try and all see the movies that are important, but we get let down, right? Like, we almost can't make the time. We have a movie podcast and it's hard for us to go see movies because they just don't feel big or important enough to really get out there and see. But so what were the winners of this summer? Like, what's the real success? Not in terms of just box office, but like quality. Is anything a step forward? Will there be any lessons learned in the years to come?
Like, what will be a model to like keep this going?
Or like what movie are we still going to talk about in years to come from this summer?
From this summer? I mean, I really think it's going to be Dunkirk. And it is because I went to a showing. It was a 70mm showing. It was on a Sunday. It was on an afternoon, and it was filled, and I was the youngest person in the theater, and I'm like, holy shit. If it could move...
The olds are back.
If it could move the olds and the Dark Knight fans, and being a PG-13 war movie that has almost, like, no dialogue that moves the plot forward, it's pretty amazing. I think we'll be talking about Dunkirk, but...
Yeah, I would say Dunkirk or Wonder Woman. I mean, I don't think that Wonder Woman is as good a movie as Dunkirk, but I think in terms of its cultural impact and the way that it will resonate for people who saw it, I mean, the cliche is that it's all little girls relating to it, and I think those will be the people who kind of look back at this like the original Superman was for a lot of people in the 70s. I think it's going to have staying power regardless of what happens with the franchise
They're apparently going to put her in the Flash movie, and they're reshooting Justice League, so she has a bigger part. So she is... Wonder Woman is like the new Batman.
Yeah, they should. I mean, it's good. Like maybe Wonder Woman winds up being like what Batman Begins was, and then her Dark Knight is still to come. Like, that would be fun.
Wonder Woman is like living the utopian in a utopian universe that we all thought we were going to be living in.
Oh God!
The last women could try on.
Your hot take: Wonder Woman would not be a hit if Hillary Clinton were president because we wouldn't all need the.
That is not my take. I want to be very clear about that. That is not my take.
I mean, you can't prove it wrong, so no. I don't know. Sure, that could totally be true.
You're saying I should run that take, and I should prep her from it. Okay.
And get ready for the tweets.
Oh, get ready for the tweets.
Always. I mean, there have been something. Is Valerian and the City of 1,000 Planets pre-sold enough that that's still going to be something that
It's not going to haunt
as cult
Luc Besson, but it's not going to be it's not a win for anyone.
All right. I think, like, if anything, this summer is going to end up, there's going to be like at least one cult classic in here that we won't see coming for like another year and a half.
Well, apparently,
I just feel like there's somewhere in like the Get Outs, Atomic Blondes, whatnot, like
Baby
those
Driver.
Like the good enough, but not really essential to anything movies that's going to explode right at some point.
Well, I'll say this, two things. One, there's 47 Meters Down, this shark movie that was supposed to go direct to DVD, and then they pumped it into theaters. I don't know exactly what, I guess the logic was, what was the Blake Lively shark movie from last year that I can't remember the name of? You know what it's called.
The Shallows.
The Shallows did very, very well, and this movie has Mandy Moore in it, so I think she's riding high from This Is Us. Why not just throw it in theaters? This movie probably was made for, you know, a few million bucks. It's made $43 million. Huge hit.
Wow.
Secret hit.
Yeah, that's insane.
But, that could be cult status. But I actually, our colleague Matt Zoller Seitz was on Twitter earlier today talking about how he thinks Alien Covenant will be seen as a as an underrated little masterpiece of a movie in the, he compared it to Blade Runner in the way that it will be reevaluated and understood in the future. I'm not sure I'm ready to go that far, but I obviously am a supporter of Alien Covenant. I thought it was fantastic. And I think that could be cult status if making $74 million at the box office allows you to be a cult.
As we try to predict the future, I'm looking back at 2007 to see if I can figure out like what happened that year that we didn't recognize. I mean, 300 was the number 10 movie of the year, so I'm not sure that counted as cult. But like that feels like the most obviously influential. I don't know. I suggest you all this do this as a thought experiment. Look 10 years ago and see what happened that summer that we now understand. Because it was a bad summer. It was a bad summer for movies.
Oh, yeah. So 20 years ago, 1997... The fifth element.
Oh, I was gonna say that's Armageddon summer.
Oh, there is an Armageddon summer. You're right. Wait, are you right?
Oh wait, was it 98? Yeah, I got that wrong. No, that's Men in Black summer.
Oh no, it is Men in Black summer. You're right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Men in Black summer and Air Force One, Fifth Element. Yeah, man, this is a fun game. This is what the segment should have been.
No, but 2007 is a lot harder because it's much nearer, and in some ways, it's still kind of hard to figure out, but. This was the year of Spider-Man 3, Shrek 3, and Pirates 3.
Transformers.
Transformers was like the start of a whole thing. I mean, but is that like the classic?
Well, it's no, actually.
2007 was Knocked Up brought back R-rated comedies.
Well, first off, right? Everyone should go to Thrillist and read our 2007 week where we actually had, well, we wrote a few things about movies in 2007, but Film Crit Hulk wrote a very good little breakdown of 2007 movies. But here, 2007 is a pivotal year and got us to 2017 because you're saying Transformers is the beginning of something, but Transformers is actually the end of something. And it's the end of director-driven blockbuster franchises. You know, Raimi's Spider-Man, that was the end. Pirates was kind of like dying out. And then we were on the precipice of the Marvel Cinematic Universe with Iron Man 2008. And, you know, we had Nolan doing Batman movies, but this is when,
his
like,
biggest hit would come the next year.
No, but here's the thing. These are all starting or kind of closing out in the 2007-2008 stretch with when you have Marvel, everyone starts to recalibrate and doing shared universes and producer-driven Kevin Feige types, you know, running the show. just like Star Wars now, you know, with Kathleen Kennedy. And Transformers is interesting because we got another one 10 years later that's now attempting to be a producer movie, even with Michael Bay. I mean, obviously he's going to leave the franchise so that they can splinter it off into a million properties. But that 2007 Transformers was a vestige of an old time when it could be that size, that small, and then it had to kept blowing up and blowing up, and now it has become a universe. It has become Galactus, consumer of universes.
There's a lot of stuff in 2007 that destroyed like the franchise they were in for a long period of time, or ended it, like Katie's saying, Pirates of the Caribbean at World End, Bourne Ultimatum, Rush Hour 3, yeah. Live Free or Die Hard, which sadly actually didn't kill it, I don't think. Fantastic Four, Rise of the Silver Surfer, Ocean's 13. We were just shutting things down all over.
It was the end.
The Golden Compass, which was the beginning and the end.
Oh. Yeah.
Resident Evil Extinction, which we thought was going to be the last Resident Evil when it came out.
It's but right even there in the title.
Talk about
Alien versus Predator Requiem.
Talk about like Seth Rogen and Knocked Up and the, yeah. the Knocked Up super bad 1-2 punch. It's like, that's a different kind of comedy. Obviously, Judd Apatow had a 40-year-old virgin, but this is like fully weaponized, understanding what it can do, what those movies should be. They are their own franchises, you know, and that click.
I would say those were pretty recognized in their time, though. I was kind of looking back to figure out, like, if Atomic Blonde is going to be the whatever of 2007. But Superbad, Knocked Up, that combo. And then Juno later that year, like, those three kind of existed all together as being like, here is a new era. And
yeah, but
Michael Cera is a movie star, which
Seth Rogen is the era, right? What? Comedy, they dominate comedy. Comedy transformed into what they do, and it doesn't exist in any other form anymore. You don't have that much comedy happening with good actors and funny scenarios and sitcom movies. You only have Seth Rogen and Judd Apatow movies.
You just talked about it.
The what?
Girls Trip. You just talked about
it. Well, that's why Girls Trip is so refreshing. It's like if there was any sense in the world – Malcolm D. Lee would be the Judd Apatow, another Judd Apatow, and he would be able to have like these women be in all sorts of movies. They should all be leading their own movies next summer, but I don't think that's the way Girls Trip is going to work in this current time in Hollywood.
I mean,
well, I would
Malcolm
hope.
Malcolm D. Lee kind of is – this is weird, really off topic. Malcolm D. Lee kind of is his own Judd Apatow. He's got his own universe of comedies that he's making. He's, you know, bouncing – he's reuniting with the same actors over and over again.
Well –
I don't know.
The secret force of that is Will Packer. Will Packer is the name.
Oh, yeah.
Like, Will Packer is the man. He has so many movies going. And what television show? I'll have to look this up. But if you want to know the secret force, it's really Will Packer. But anyway, let them make more movies. God damn it. Anyway.
Summer of 2017. Please tell me what you think your cult classics from 2007 are that weren't recognized in their time, which is the original thing I was talking about, which is why I didn't bring up Seth Rogen.
My answer to that, since we're back on it, Zodiac was 2007.
I was looking at that because it wasn't a summer movie. I thought it didn't qualify, but that summer wasn't provided. Yeah, Zodiac definitely not recognized in its time has come back around. It's hard to, I don't know, it's a weird year.
Yeah.
A lot of these dumb movies. Okay.
Hit us up with some of that on the tweets.
Yeah. That does it for this week's Writing in the War Room. We'll be back next week with the Quarter Quell. Finally. It took us a little while. We're excited to do it. In the meantime, tell the people who you are.
I'm Matt Patches, the executive entertainment editor of Thrillist.com. I'm on Twitter at Mr. Patches, and you can visit us at our website, fightinginthewarroom.com, where you can leave messages. You can listen to episodes. We will check it out every so often, trying to get back to you. But yeah, you can also listen to Opkino classic episodes if you need to be inspired for our Quarter Quell and want to weigh in. And that is fightinginthewarroom.com/opkino_classic. Right? Am I right about that, Dave?
That's right.
Yes.
That's exactly right. I'm Dave Gonzalez. You can find me on Twitter at DA7E, and there I'll be pinning a lot of my excellent work for Thrillist.com about Game of Thrones, helping you cut it all apart. But if you're a fan of this podcast, and, you know, we only talk Game of Thrones occasionally, you could engage with us even more on Facebook at Facebook.com, and just search Fighting in the War Room. Give us a like. Join our little community going on there. Give us some Quarter Quell ideas.
I'm Katie Rich. I'm thinking about what would happen if Beowulf were the truly undersung influential hit from 2007, and where we'd all be if that were the case. You can find me at vanityfair.com or on Twitter at Katie Rich, K-A-T-E-Y-R-I-C-H. And you can find all of us on Twitter talking about 2007, 2017, and beyond at F-I-T-W-R, where you can also answer this week's lightning round question, which was...
In honor of Annabelle the Creation, what's your favorite piece of spin-off culture?
Thanks for listening, and we'll be back talking to you next week.